I've always been a proud Jew, but never a very observant one. That's the first line of Good Book by David Plotz. It's his memoir of his time spent reading every single word of the Old Testament to learn about his faith, to meet the God who'd broken his heart, and to discover what exactly is inside the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament. By book's end, Plotz was no believer, but he found a way to love the Bible without making his peace with God. According to Plotz, the idea was born at a cousin's bat mitzvah.
I got started because I was bored at my cousin's bat mitzvah. And I don't know if you've ever been to a bat mitzvah, but some bat mitzvahs can linger on. And this was an incredibly long bat mitzvah. And so I just grabbed the Bible in the pew back in front of me and kind of flipped it open at random. And I came upon a story in the book of Genesis, the story of Dinah, or Dinah, depending on your tradition, who's a daughter of Jacob, who goes out and is raped, and then the rapist wants to marry her. And Jacob's sons, who are Dinah's brothers, say, okay, well, you can marry our sister, but the condition is that you have to get circumcised before you can marry her. And so the rapist says, okay, I'll get circumcised. Not just you, you and all the men of your town. So he and all the men of his town get circumcised. And while they're incapacitated from the circumcision, Jacob's sons, Dinah's brothers, show up and murder them all and take their women and children as slaves and sack the town. And then when Jacob, their father, kind of complains about this and says, hey, it's going to be hard to live in this neighborhood if you're going to be killing everybody, they say, what? Did you want our sister to be treated like a whore? And I read this story and I thought, you know, they didn't teach me this in Temple Sinai. And this is not hiding way back in the book of Zephaniah or Habakkuk or some part of the Bible no one ever reads. It's right in the middle of Genesis, the one book of the Bible everyone thinks they've read. I thought, if this is in the middle of Genesis, what else is there? And so I decided I was going to read the whole book, starting with in the beginning and going to the end.
So can you give us a kind of primer? Where do we start with the Old Testament once we've gotten past the begats?
Well, okay, so the primer is God, you know, he picks out his people to lead them to greatness, and these people are the Jews, the Israelites, and they disappoint him, and then they try to get back in his favor, and they do briefly, and then they disappoint him again and again, and then ultimately are defeated militarily and politically and driven out of Israel into exile. And that's the basic story. God, you know, there's no easy way to say this. God is a horrible God. The God of the Jews is a very disturbing character. He calls himself loving and merciful and kind, and yet there's no act of, you know, kindness or mercifulness or very few acts of love in the book. And that the story, at least as it comes down to us, is of a jealous, angry God who is constantly disappointed because humans fail and we are frail. And then he commits acts of, you know, ruthless genocide against apparently innocent people who just happen not to be in our tribe. So I think that as a biography of God, the Hebrew Bible is really, really, really troubling.
Well, at the very least, the religious lesson is that we have that in our background and need to be aware of it. If you're looking for a morality tale, I suppose.
That's a fair reading. That's a very fair reading. And I think, well, for somebody like me who found myself more and more disturbed by God's acts of genocide or by the particular, you know, vessels that God chose and the acts that God committed, which are very troubling, there is a counter to it, which is that the most heroic characters in the Bible for me, and I would count Abraham as one of these, Moses at times, Job, a little-known prophet called Gideon, are characterized not by their obedience or their faith, but rather by their questioning of God and their doubt of God. And to me, the greatest moment in the Bible actually occurs almost right immediately after those begats. So you really should wish you'd gotten to it. But almost immediately after the begats, God drops by Abraham's tent and says, I'm on my way to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, for their sin is so great. And Abraham says, but you know, the Lord of the universe, the creator of the universe, the dispenser of justice, how can you destroy these cities if there is even 500 innocent people living in there? And God says, okay, I can't do it. And Abraham says, well, what if there are 50 innocent people? And God says, okay, not if they're 50. And Abraham says, 45. And God says, okay, not if they're 45. And Abraham talks him down. God was preparing to sort of just smite thoughtlessly and universally. And Abraham, is the voice speaking up and saying, you are doing wrong, God. And those moments are the clarifying and majestic moments in the Bible for me.
Is that why you think we should, more of us, read the Bible as part of school, for instance? Is it the same sort of thing as Shakespeare or Mark Twain?
It is. It is absolutely the same sort of thing. So I think several compelling reasons. The first compelling reason is that the Bible, more than any book, more than Shakespeare, I think you could claim even, more than the Constitution, defines the culture and language of our world. So you cannot know anything about how we speak and how we write and, you know, what our idea of story is without knowing its origins in the Bible. So again and again in the Bible, you come across a phrase, a word, a plot of a story, and you realize, oh my goodness, that's where this comes from. That's the source of you know, how I speak today. So I think just for purely cultural reference purposes, you need to know it. Then I think it is, when you think about what our laws are and how our society is structured, it is foundational. And to pretend or to educate our children and have them believe that, you know, the U.S. Constitution and ideas about, you know, what our laws are spring majestically forth in 1776 without any antecedents and without there being any religious element to it is to do a great injustice to our children, is to give them a false sense of where their culture and their government comes from. And then finally, even if you're somebody who is not a believer, or you don't care one way or another, there's a significant number of Americans who base their whole life and how they live on what they have read in the Bible, what they've been taught from the Bible.
Listening to you talk, it's hard to believe that at the end of this you didn't feel even more brokenhearted about God than you said you were at the beginning. But I get the feeling that's not true for you.
You know, it's interesting. We're talking today, and I haven't talked about the book for a couple of weeks, but in that period, I've actually been writing the afterword for the paperback edition. And as I was writing the afterword, I realized that actually I was much more brokenhearted. Or that what made me love the Bible and continue to love the Bible has nothing to do with God. That the God part of the Bible continues to disturb and repel and horrify me. And the human parts of the Bible do not. Insofar as we can say this is a work of man, which talks about our relationship to each other and the sort of fundamental questions about how we build societies, the Bible enthralls and thrills and delights me. Insofar as it is a story of a divine being who guides us and to whom we look to for solace and leadership, it appalls me. And I can't be there with the God that's in there. So I think I've found a way to love the Bible without loving God anymore.
David Plotz is the editor of SlateMagazine.com and the author of Good Book,